Today is February 24th, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I'm interviewing Bob Bartholomew over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Bob, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born in Allentown, Pennsylvania, February 9th, 1936.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family and growing up there?
Well, my mother raised seven children by herself. So pretty early in life, I went to work, you know, to help with the family. And that was probably it. You know, I went to, you know, high school. I took welding up as a trade. And for me, that's just exactly how it went. My mom was a terrific woman to take on a job of seven children and raising us all herself was a job in itself.
I'm sure. What were your earliest athletic pursuits?
First in my life, I played football. And after the football, before the football, I lifted just bodybuilding. Gained weight and this and that there for football. Then after football, I went to work after that there. But then I continued to train in bodybuilding. But as far as the bodybuilding, I got tired of being picked for who you know most of the times. You weren't always the first place winner. It was never the best. So I went into lifting because a very good friend of mine was years older than me. He was a lifter from Emmaus, Pennsylvania, Dale Hartman. So I started training with him lifting. And then I continued on that for a number of years.
Mm. Did you have any sports role models or heroes that you admired when you were growing up?
Well, I had a lot of, not sports models, but mainly I had a lot of people, judges, older people at the Allentown YMCA were my mentors that really kept me in line, you know, that I didn't go astray as a young man. And that was probably it. Not like athletes or anything else, but important people in the community that really were always in my corner for anything I had to do.
Mm. Were any of your brothers or sisters involved in sports, and did they influence your participation at all?
My youngest brother was into bodybuilding. He won Mr. Lehigh Valley at the time and had a massive heart attack and passed away when he was 25 years old.
Oh.
So, you know, that was mainly out of the family that we had, four boys and three girls. Only him and I were really the ones that ever did anything in sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more about who first introduced you to lifting as a sport?
As a sport, we were in the gym training all the time, and I wanted to win on my own. I didn't want somebody picking me, and in lifting, either make the lift or you don't lift. I mean, make the lift. So for me, that's really how I really stayed at it.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any formal coaching for your training?
No. No, what I did was a lot of it came from reading articles like Strength and Health magazine, which is out of business now. They had always had a monthly magazine. And actually, when I looked in there, a lot of the stuff that I learned right from that magazine and then put it into my routine working out.
Mm-hmm. How much of a difference did coaching make in your overall preparation for the games?
I always hate to answer this question, but I never had any coaching whatsoever.
Mm.
I mean, I anything I learned, I picked up on my own. Even in Mexico City, I don't know. I never seen a coach around. I was one of the guys on a team that weren't from that, I would say, clique of lifters that were from the New York club. I was from Pennsylvania, Allentown, and I would go down there on a Saturday train because I got to a point where I needed somebody better than me that I could really go into a workout and mentally get into it. So I used to go to York, Pennsylvania on a Saturday morning and lift with all the team members of different years that trained there. So, you know, that's the way I actually did it.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I would have had a coach or financial backing, but at that time you didn't, only a few people had that.
Mm-hmm.
I could have went to York for peanuts and worked for them. And that would have been, because all I ended up doing was training, but it never paid what my trade paid me, so I never would have done that.
I see.
So a lot of guys on a York team, they ended up getting college degrees and worked for York and had guys in your corner all the time. The fellow that I beat, he was on two Olympic teams. He had like a trainer there with him all the time, rubbing his trapezes, you know, whatever, and psyching him up mentally, stuff like that. Well, I didn't have any of that. In fact, Bob Huffman from the New York Barbell Club wrote some articles. He couldn't understand how I improved the way I did compared to what the job I did all day. And he said, and all the injuries that I had. He's phenomenal. He works hard all day, lifts weights at night, and, you know, it was just the way it was in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I admire the people that, you know, I had some financial and coaching people with them. It has to help you, not hinder you.
I'm sure. Bob, can you tell me about the Olympic trials, about the process and how you made the team?
Well, they had the Olympic trials in York, Pennsylvania. I went down there to compete. I got second place, and they took a team that was considered, at some of the classes, they didn't put the people in them weight classes because they figured they couldn't place high enough to help the United States. And I was picked as the second 198-pounder, and I went along to compete. I competed from a guy by the name of Philip Capaldi from New Jersey, and he was only maybe 20, 21 years old. But he improved all. He was very good.
Hmm. How did your friends and family and your employer react when they found out that you were going to compete in the Olympic Games?
My friends were all very proud. Even my grandmother, who was born in Austria, she'd watch that television every night looking for me. And my mom, she was happy too that I made the team. As far as the employee, I worked out of a union hall. So my employee could be changed 2-3 times a year. And I was working on a job which they called time and material. And the Olympic coach, John Turpak, he had said a letter to the owner of this company that I was working for. And they, at the time, said, well, we'll reimburse him some of the wages that, because nobody knew you were there or not. It was in the Bethlehem Steel plant. There might have been 100 of you working there. And, you know, but the bottom line is I never got a nickel. And when I come home, I was went back to work for about a week, which I never cared. And then I got laid off. From being laid off, I just go back to the union hall. And I got another job right away because I was a welder and we were in demand. I used to almost be able to call my own. No, I don't want that job. I'll take that one there. I work at nuclear power plants or something like that. There I do. I got to be pretty proficient in what I did. You know, like somebody in college that takes up an occupation or whatever they want to do, and school teachers or whatever, I put my mind on to be the best in what I did, weightlifting, welding, whatever it would be.
Mm-hmm. Describe your training and preparation in the months leading up to the games. Were there any different methods or techniques that you used as compared to earlier in your weightlifting career?
Well, yes. We had like a biorhythm type thing that we followed, and we paced ourselves in our daily workouts that we'd peak at a certain time. You know, it was a little different. You'd maybe work 50% of the weights that you lifted one day, then the next day maybe you go to 75%, and then back. You had to know how your body was taken to all these different workouts you were taking. And basically that was it. And we were in Denver, Colorado training, and I still to this day tell people, I peaked too soon. I mean, I didn't even have my best day in the Olympics. I had it in Denver, Colorado, in a training session. So I peaked. And then when I'm going into the Olympic Games, I already was in my body rhythm, was already at the top point, and I'm starting to come down. You know, it's hard to really understand it, but I didn't first believe it either, but it is a certain way you train, or maybe I overtrained for it. I don't know.
Hmm. Did the altitude of Mexico City factor into your training at all?
I would say no, because our training was that we went to Denver to get outfitted with our uniforms and everything else, and then that was a high altitude Denver, Colorado. We trained there, but our type of competition was one explosive movement. So during that movement, you know, you're boom and you're done. But people in track and field and other ones that took a lot more endurance, they were affected by it.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware of how your training compared to that of your teammates?
I would say yes. I mean, I honestly, and I don't like to, you know, sound negative, but when you're with those guys all training together, you get better representatives there with you. You get better vitamin and food and the conditions. I trained at home by myself at the YMCA with a couple lifters, you know, that weren't, not bragging, but not my caliber at that time, right? Because I improved that much training. So I would say if I could have really financially afforded it, I was married at the time and had one child. And if I could have took that type work in York, I could have even improved myself better. But training here in my hometown, I'm lucky I just had one or two lifters that were lighter weight classes that were pretty good, and then I trained with them.
Mm. How about the training of your competitors? Were you aware of how your training compared to those of people from other national teams?
I would say you're talking about other countries.
Yes.
Okay. You really didn't know. All you did was whatever you read that they did in world championships or the Russians were doing or the Hungarians were doing. It was only what you really read because they're another country miles away. So you really didn't know other than what you read.
Mm-hmm. And you already talked about this before, but can you go into a little bit more detail about the role that York Barbell and Bob Hoffman played in your preparation just before the Olympic Games?
I would say Bob Hoffman was one heck of a man. People say he ruined weightlifting. He was the father of weightlifting. And he was a millionaire and owned the York Barbell Club and all kind of heating places and made all kind of equipment for weightlifting. like for bodybuilding and everything. But I would say with, between him, because I used to say, hey, Bob, you know, it cost me gas to come down here. You go right in his pocket and hand me a 20 or something, you know, just to, for me to come down here on a Saturday. And I'd go out for lunch or something. He'd pick up the tab. You know, it was, he, to me, I liked him the best. I mean, he wasn't along in Mexico. His general manager was the coach, John Turpak. But he's the one, actually, that really took me in his side and knew the training that I went through and the injuries that I went through. And really, to me, I don't know for a fact, but I think I can thank him for making the Olympic team, because he was one of the men that were on the picking team after the tryouts. And I didn't even leave the tryouts already. He came up to me, he said, you're on the team. Actually, I got on the phone and called a few of my friends and everything right away.
Did you have any close friends on the Olympic team?
When you consider, to me, they were just all teammates. They weren't like really close friends like what I was raised with or trained with. Some of them, you know, most of them, everybody just about stayed to themselves. Some of the guys came down with their girlfriends. They weren't even around. They were out in Mexico City with their girlfriends and that. So you really almost trained by yourself. In one of the colleges, have like a huge gymnasium, and maybe all the different countries and yourself were training there. And a lot of times the coach, like I said, was never around, and you never had no real training time. So I picked my time, and I'd go to like not get on a bus and go to this college and train in the mornings. And half the team would come whenever they felt like it. And really, that's what it was, you know.
Do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. Olympic team, particularly the track team?
Well, I never heard about any of that stuff, but I've seen when it happened, when outside in the Olympic Village, but outside of our high rise that we were staying, I looked out the window, and I could tell you, the wrestlers, they were throwing buckets of water down on them, and people that were there. It wasn't a racist thing for these wrestlers or that to do. They just didn't like that they were doing it. And to me, I still say the photographer, the press, agitated this more than it should have been. I honestly believe they should have just ignored them. If I could have won a medal and put my hand up to the ear that I'm proud to be an American and on the team, that's what I would have did. There'd be no protesting. They don't. In my mind, I didn't care if a guy was black, green, brown, Jewish, Protestant, Catholic. That didn't go through my mind when I was there. I was there to try and win something. You know, and the protest thing, I just don't believe in that. I mean, I know all these people from slavery and that, but that was a long time ago. I don't think that it should still be done, but they also have their right that they want to do it. And I, like myself, I was raised around all nationalities, and you know, everybody might make a comment, but I never was a racist, and I don't intend to be one until the day I die. I just feel that everybody's equal. You make your own bed, sleep in it, you know, and that's my philosophy.
Do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
Well, when I was training, you could still see. I mean, here, there still was shooting going on. When we were training, you could hear rifles and that being shot somewhere in the city. I mean, they still were protesting themselves, but I never actually seen it because it was supposed to be just about over. But there were still some shots being fired.
Oh, did your wife attend the games?
Now, my wife and I, when I left, she wasn't even talking to me. Because I really, my whole life, which I know it wasn't the right thing to do, but my whole life was training. And, you know, when I came home, she didn't even come see me. I come home, but we were still together. But the only meet she ever went to, because she went to a national championship with me. And we weren't married then. And also, like, they used to have a big picnic in New York, Pennsylvania on Labor Day. And for years, many, many years. And then we'd be on a stage and giving a demonstration. She was at one of those picnics.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just something. It was actually, I still think, not her fault as much as mine. Because all I had on my mind, and you might say is myself. And I wasn't myself. I just wanted to train. And that's all I had. Even with injuries, I trained through injuries, through surgeries. I mean, stuff where I should have been rested. Where today, if I would have been training today, and I had a hip operation, there's no way I'd be in the gym working out. I'd let that thing heal up very well, and then it'll take me a week or two to get back into the groove again. But I train with stitches in me, cortisone shot in my knees. I had 5 knee operations. I mean, I had operations all over.
Mm.
But to me, that's how dedicated it was, or selfish. I don't know which term to use, but I just like to train that hard. And when I set my mind on almost anything, I do the best I can.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of Mexico City and the people there when you first arrived for the games?
Well, I'll tell you, a couple of days that I went in and like into the market or into the city, I used to go by myself different places. And this little girl, because I was missing my baby son, this little girl, when I was in it, I said, come here, and I gave her an Olympic tin. And her mom was standing there. I thought, oh, boy, now her mother's saying, wait, in broken English. I said, gee, did I do something wrong? I didn't, you know, but she came running back, and she had like a necklace, something about Mexico, and she put it all around my neck, and she was so happy. And I thought the people of Mexico were very, very hospitable to us, people that were there. The only time I went to a flea market, and there was a way they say you're supposed to try and bargain with them. And I said to the kid, because I bought my mom a leather purse and my wife a purse and a couple other things. And I said to the guy, he said, well, we're poor. This, I said, yeah, but you got better clothes on than I have. And I was laughing with him, you know, because he could speak English pretty well. And but, you know, they're all hustling. Selling T-shirts or whatever, you know, it was part for them to make some money. Mm-hmm. I could see it.
What did you think of the event venues and the athletic facilities?
Facilities were very good. I had we all had our own room. The team had competed at that particular time, and then you had your name painted on like a sign or poster that's your room, and be in the room training, and getting ready, and then you'd go out and they had a little warm-up room where you warmed up prior to taking your attempts in the lifts, and probably that's the only time I've seen the coach around. and he was there, you know, he was there, as a thing, but for me, it wasn't enough that I think a coach should do. Because when I watched this year, the guy was a coach for the gymnast years ago. And that girl, she hurt her ankle,
mm-hmm.
but still took it again. Crowley or something, the guy's name was.
Yeah.
I mean, he actually picked her up. I mean, he was there for his team. And it amazed me. Because I remember having Kathy Rigby had us, we had a big dinner for some of the gymnasts and the weightlifting team at the 21st Street building in Denver. And I laughed because they had, I used to always wear a suit and tie, and the coach stood up and introduced us. He said, "This is the only guy that don't look like a lifter." I always have to tell him, "Don't wear a suit and tie," and he wears it anyway. I'd always wanted to look sharp looking, and I wore a suit and tie, and I'm sitting beside of Kathy Rigby. She was about 14 years old, and I was like 31 or something at the time. I said, "They couldn't even set me aside of a girl close to my age."
Yeah. What about the security measures? What were your impressions of the security measures at the games?
I actually didn't notice any security, only when you left the Olympic Village or came back. They gave you like a passport with your picture on it, and I still have it to this day. They wanted to see that passport, but you weren't getting in the village. And when you walked up the village, it might have been like 40 steps to the top, a small decking area, and 40 steps down again. I mean, they wanted to check you out pretty close, but it wasn't like you see like in Russia now, if you watch the TV or any other country, because terrorists weren't really anything at that time. So security was, you know, getting in and out. You know, that was a tighter. You didn't just walk past them. They wanted to see that passport with your picture on it.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe your accommodations in the Olympic Village?
I thought it was very good. We were on the 7th floor, and most of the guys each had two in a bedroom. And we had a bedroom, nice area, bathroom, showers, and then like a huge living room area that you sat out there and bat the breeze and whatever went on, you know, in the day. But really, that was it. A lot of people didn't really hang around for whatever reason in the village. They had elevators to go up and down the steps. Down in the first floor, they had medical people there. Say you got some drinking their water, or whatever, if you had some kind of a sickness, cold, they had medical staff there that would take care of you. It was good. I thought there was nothing wrong with that, our facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they had the men and the women, they had us fenced off. You couldn't go, think you're going over into the women's side. And as far as the eating, they had about, I would say, this is just guessing, 10 dining rooms for all the people, countries that had their type of foods. And then they had one huge one where they had that they called the international. You go in there and you know, eat whatever you wanted. And then they had on Sunday, they had their religious services. They had a place for that. I really thought Mexico did a terrific job there. They did terrific. And, you know, for being probably a poorer country, they still did. They did great.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did better than the Russians did this year, because when I watched this TV, yellow water in the bathroom. On TV, they showed it. I mean, the water coming out of spigots for water. You wanted to go to the bathroom, they had two toilets there. Like, you're going to go to the bathroom with somebody sitting right beside you? Get out. So, yeah, but I mean, and I'm not knocking, just talking to Russia. So, but Mexico, for being a poor country, they had very good facilities.
What about the opening ceremony? What are your most vivid memories of the opening ceremony?
Now you're asking the one that I love. Opening ceremonies was the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my life. I could not believe when we marched in that Olympic Village, all the countries. And I had goosebumps all over me. And I just, to me, it was a bigger highlight than competing. I really loved that. I mean, the unity, all the countries marching, and nobody out. It's not like closing ceremonies where you just run wild. This was, you were all lined up, and it was really phenomenal. And then we're all standing there, and then they let all the pigeons out. And I'm watching people that were on Olympic teams prior. They're pulling out these $1.98 raincoats. And at first, I wondered, what the heck are they putting raincoats on for? Well, after them pigeons took off, I knew why. So, I mean, they let hundreds of pigeons on it. But it was, for me, the Olympic opening ceremony was great. Mm. For me, it was the highlight of the whole games.
Did you have any memorable interactions or experiences with people from other national teams?
Some of the Hungarian team came to visit us in the Olympic Village, in our hotel where we still were high rise. Some of them came around, and a couple Russians, but not too much. You know, I was mostly track and field. You talk to them, people, you went and watched their events and that. But the other countries, you know, they were pretty well kept on a leash. And they're European countries. It was like maybe they were in the military almost. They were always watched pretty closely.
With 1968 being a height of the Cold War in Vietnam, what effect, if any, did the political climate have on the games and interactions between athletes?
I don't think any, to be honest with you. I mean, people were against the Vietnam War, and they were protesting all over the United States. For me, I didn't really see anything, or even anybody really talking about Vietnam when I was there. Like me, I'm against all wars. I'd always say I don't think we should have been in Iraq, Afghanistan. Because the Americans, as strong as we are, we don't go into anything to win. These kids getting their legs and limbs, men and female, taken off. There's no reason for it. We got the greatest Air Force in the world. And for me, I don't know why we just don't go in to win. Don't just send our young people over there to fight. No. You know, you go there to win, not to lose. If you're going to go in another country and they want you there, you go there to win. But there wasn't much on Vietnam. Because I had a lot of friends that were in Vietnam, younger than me. You know, when they came home, they didn't even want to talk about it. Even to this day, there's a couple of them come to the gym to work out, and you never even hear them speak about it.
Well, as far as your competition goes, who was your biggest competition at the games?
As of other countries, I would say at that time, Sweden, Hungary. Well, the American kid that beat me, he was, you know, top. He placed about fourth. I think there was two brothers that were very good from one of the European countries. They were all ahead of us. I mean, I was missing lifts that they were warming up with. Mm. And it was what I considered my worst lift in competition. But they were, you know, like I said before, they were like on a leash. They didn't fit. And they were all strictly business. I mean, I've seen a Russian slap one of his team members because he missed two lifts. And he slapped on this. And it actually was a psychological thing to get him to make that third lift, or he would have been out, you know, out of the competition. He made the lift, but he gave him a slap on the face when he came up.
What did you do immediately after your event? Did you relax? Did you call family? Did you go to other events?
I went to most of the times. I went to a lot of the events, and I was even going to events before, you know, before I even competed. Track and field is what I really went to see a lot. A little boxing, and some of the weightlifting, like the other ones that would lift at different times or different days before I lifted, I'd go watch that. But like I said, it just didn't seem for me, like our team, to be like family. And maybe it was me. I don't know, because I was like maybe the second oldest guy on the team. And, you know, maybe they were a lot younger than me, and, you know, they went their way, and it was, we're not hanging around him. I mean, that's just the way of it. It wasn't family. I mean, I had more family when I trained together with Don in New York, and down there it was strictly business, too. On a Saturday morning, and it was business. You went there to train. There was no comical stuff going on or joking around. You trained.
What about testing for banned or performance-enhancing substances? These were the first games at which drug testing was implemented. What was the experience of testing like? Did you get tested?
No. What they were doing at that time, I think, and they were only doing it random. First, second, and third. They didn't even do, I don't recall them even doing the three places. They did, maybe they did a random test, get the guy in 148-pound class, bring him in. That's the way they test it. And, you know, I think most of them, if they tested everybody back in them days, would have flunked. It was just something that the Europeans brought up and the Americans in all sports started experimenting with also. And most people weren't even doing as much as European people were doing as far as milligrams or with any whatever. And for me, when you're in competition, I believe you try anything. You tell every kid that ever was in a sport, don't you ever do that. But boy, when you get up in that caliber, if they tell you to drink tea and honey, and if you got it in your head that helped you, you could be drinking a lot of tea and honey. You know, it's just a shame. It isn't like Jesse Owens or at the times of like Jim Thorpe, them kind of athletes. They never did anything wrong. All they did was train.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Europeans. So I guess it was known that the Europeans were using some kind of performance.
Oh yeah. Oh yes. Oh yes. That's how everybody else really got wise to it. And I mean, they even were blood doping. I mean, they took blood from them weeks before the tournament when he got down into competition in not just Mexico but any competition. They'd inject the blood back into him. I mean, it was something, you just man up, just like the guy on the bicycle, Lance Armstrong. Don't lie. You're just making a story up. Tell the truth and tell the truth why you did something. Don't lie to the public. If you did something, man up. Tell the truth. You know, because they're not going to like that one black young lady. I mean, they took her medals and everything away from her, track and field girl. This was after Mexico. Well, for me, she lied, and that was the worst thing. And years later now, she's on TV every once in a while. She says, don't lie. You know, she's sorry that she did, but if you ever look at some of those track and field females and you watch them compete, this isn't oatmeal they're eating in the morning, I'll guarantee you. they have such masking things they could do even now that as soon as they find something, they take that to it, it doesn't show up. But the doping community, they're up pretty good on everything now.
Hmm.
I don't think you get as many. And I guarantee you, if you win, they're going to check you. They got all the latest tests to give you.
Right. Gender verification testing was introduced in 1968 and implemented at the Summer Games. Do you remember anything about hearing anything about that gender verification testing for the women?
I really didn't. I mean, there was one woman that I think it was track and field that looked more like a guy. I mean, but we never heard very much on the weightlifting and wrestlers or whatever that in our building about anything, you know, about like a gender test, and that's taken a sport pretty far.
Yep.
I don't think that medal I wouldn't want to put around my neck.
Mm.
If they could say, well, Bob, we're going to let you, we're going to give you some, let your hair grow. Who is it? You're going to enter a female competition. I'd say, no, thank you.
1968 was a pivotal time in the American Civil Rights Movement and in race relations in the U.S. And also that year, Martin Luther King had been assassinated in the spring.
Yeah.
What effect, if any, do you think this climate had on Olympians and on the games?
Well, I just think I don't think it had a real big thing, but it was the guys that stood on that, because not that many black athletes were protesting. It was only three or four people that protested. And I really don't think it had, because you're pretty well told you're representing the United States. You know, not yet you go to Catholic Church on Sunday. You're representing the United States. Because I had a little Masonic patch I wanted to put on my uniform in the coast, and just like the one that's on her on USA.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Smith and Carlos, the gentlemen who raised their fists on the medal podium, they were immediately expelled from the village.
Yes, yes. And to me, that was the right thing to do. Get the temperaments down. This, you got to go right now. That president of Mexico City, I believe he was the one that expelled them immediately. You're out of here.
Hmm.
And John Carlos and Smith and that, you know, whatever their thinking was, you know, God bless them. But like I said, you should be proud to be able to represent the United States. You're not representing that your parents came from Germany or Israel or whatever. You're representing the United States, and that's it. People come to this country for a better life.
Do you have any specific memories of any record-setting events or special athletic accomplishments that you witnessed at the games?
The most one was the guy got the hamburger, the boxer. I can't even think of his name right now, but he went around the rim with a ring with a little American flag, which was very impressive.
George Foreman,
yes.
Mm-hmm. So you
that was impressive. And naturally, our basketball team, you know, we got a, in that year, we got a little bit of shaft or whatever term you want to use. I mean, I watched that game. That last shot that the Russians made, that was way late. But they, and now anymore, it's them type sports, even hockey. They're all professionals, you know. They're not even letting the kids that are in college or kids that train hard make the Olympic teams. We want to win so bad, the country. But all the basketball players, some of them say, we're not even going to the next one. I won two gold medals, and, you know, and they're making millions and millions of dollars a year.
Mm.
And none of them stay in the village. they all have special hotel rooms, and because they're all high-profile athletes,
mm-hmm.
I still wish it was all amateur. I even tell people that at one time they wanted to put me on a milk carton here when I won the title, Mr. Lehigh Valley, when I was bodybuilding. I said, no, I want to stay an amateur. Because I would have got paid. I could have got paid modeling. I wouldn't do it. You know, when I think about it today, they'll all do it. You want to pay me a couple hundred dollars, a couple thousand dollars? Yeah, I'll do it. You know, I just had that amateur thing in me, and I thought it was the right way. And it was back in them days. You know, the rules are you can't get more than $35 or something, and that's the rule. Don't break the rules. Rules are made for a reason. I don't always brag about it, but I always, my whole life, I tried to have good morals and good respect, and I just don't feel it's right. You know, if somebody says it's wrong and they vote on it, it's wrong.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about amateurism as it was then in 68 versus now. You've already pretty much hit on that, but any other thoughts about that?
Not really. You know, the only other thing I see, you talk about amateur sports, them track and field people that were good. There was an Adidas giving sneakers out to all the athletes in the Olympic Village. A lot of them track and field ones, when they got their sneakers, there might have been a $100 bill stuffed in it, so they'd wear them sneakers for the track meet.
Ah, interesting.
I mean, that was the way a lot of times, I seen it with the Adidas people in the Olympic Village.
Hmm.
You were a well-known track person. There was something in that an envelope in them sneakers.
Ah.
Yeah, which is, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing, because I know how much it cost me to compete over the years.
Yeah. Well,
you know, it cost me probably my marriage and everything else.
Well, for you personally, what was the most memorable part of competing in the 68 Olympic Games?
In the competing end of it, making the last lift. It seemed like somebody took 10,000 pounds off my shoulders. It was like, wow, am I glad it's over? Oh, yeah. You psych your brain up so much. It is hard. And I honestly believe that a lot of it is mentally than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I never seen the people out in the audience. I used to be able to concentrate better on trying to make the lift, than I could do in school. I could get out there, I never knew nobody was even there. I could put my mind right there and see the lift being completed in my mind before I walked up to the bar to do it. And another thing I always tell young people today, when I was young and coming up, the national championships, in my mind was, I had pictures in my bedroom. I want to win the nationals. Then my next goal was, I want to go to the Olympics. Well, that something was a negative. I should have said, I want to win the Olympics, and put it in the back burner in my mind and really train that way.
Hmm.
And that's what young athletes, excuse me, should do. Say, I want to win. Not make the team, I want to win.
Because
I still think the larger percent is mental. You're trained, your body's going to do it. Now you got to get your mind to help you.
Yeah. So you already talked a little bit about the closing ceremony, but what was your experience at the closing ceremony?
Closing ceremonies, I wasn't there. I took a plane and flew home because I had lost so many weeks of work already, just training in New York and then training in Colorado and then training for the Olympics, that I said to the coach, I said, I'm going to go home. and then he got me a plane ticket, and I got out of there. I wish I would have been here. I've seen closing ceremonies on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them, not most of them, but a few of them, that their girlfriends were there, they were gone too. They didn't go to closing ceremonies.
Hmm.
But that has to be a great feeling, too. Walking here, united, all the countries. You read the newspaper today, you get sick reading it. All the countries, a lot of them walking hand in hand. You can't beat that.
Yeah.
It's an experience in your life that you should take when you're there.
Because
I never heard bad things said about any country or anybody or them saying about us. I mean, we knew already how much the government helped these other countries compared to ours. So you really had that negative thing almost out of your mind. That's the way the European people treat their athletes. I mean, I heard Ralph Boston at a world championship, he tripped or something, fell in a gutter. They just walked back. In America, they just walked past him. In Europe, they'd pick you up. In Europe, when you came home, the whole village or the whole city was there to see you. Here, nobody's here.
Huh.
You come on the airplane, you get off, you get on, that's all.
So was that your experience upon your return, your homecoming?
Oh, yeah. I always say there's one guy, and I was raised with him, and I never hung around or because he was, you know, a college graduate, and he went his way. But he sent me I'll never forget it. Every once in a while I see him, and I say to him, "You're the only person that sent me a telegram, and I thank you for that." And I said, "Don't forget, you and I were the only ones in the Lehigh Valley in the soapbox for me." Nobody says, you don't forget, no matter how old you get, all these little things come back to you.
Can you kind of give me a summary of what happened with your lifting career after 68?
After 68, I was so burned out and trained so hard, that was the last. I never lifted a heavy weight again after the Olympics.
Oh, wow.
I went right into just exercising for my own health reason and purpose. I never even did another, what they call squats. I never did another set of squats. I trained so hard. I just was like, you could say burned out. I just had it. A lot of people can continue. I couldn't. That was the last tournament I entered. I never went to another one. I went to one we had the Russians in Allentown. And River ran the competition, and they were like an exhibition. I didn't even know about it till the day of the competition. I went out, and then when I was there, one of the coaches from this high school knew me, and he said, "Bob, come over here." And I came over, and he said, "Sit with this announcer, and you know, and kind of narrate with him." So that's what I did. But the Russians were here; they lifted. They were in the United States. They came to this. They were at this high school and gave a demonstration.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that was. It was even for me. I never even knew they were going to be here. You know, but I knew when I found out, I was going to go watch it. And naturally, I ended up being a narrator on the radio program.
Oh, cool. So, you mentioned earlier that you are still going to a gym?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
today was my gym day. When I woke up, I was lazy, so I didn't go. And I try and get in 2-3 times a week just to do some little bit of exercise, treadmill exercises, you know, nothing. But I still, I'm lighter body weight than I was training back in M day. I keep my body weight down. And I try and, you know, for my age, I'm doing good, so.
Yeah.
I don't even like to mention my age because every time I mention it and I go in a gym and I watch these kids working heavy, I get a little depressed.
Oh.
I said, well, I remember when I used to lift that. Then when I'm standing there watching these guys, I think, how did I ever do it? I mean, they're not lifting, they're bodybuilding, but they use heavy weights.
Right.
Lifting is almost a thing in the United States That's out. It's not even around anymore. I can't even find a magazine that has something in about lifting. You can find all the bodybuilding books you want on the racks. I'm not looking for bodybuilding books no more. I like sports on them.
Yeah. What impact has being an Olympian had on your life?
As far as any, it for me, just being proud and people telling me that you should be proud, or even, oh, he was on the Olympic team, or even to this day, when I meet somebody and they say, yeah, Bob was on the Olympic team, 1968, these younger kids are that, they get a smile on their face. I mean, in that end of it, it is really good. You just don't forget it.
Yeah.
You know, I have every patch. I put 160 trophies out for garbage last year. But I got 160, I got maybe another 50 trophies in my apartment here. I got the medals, the national championships. You just don't forget that. And I told my buddy, he said, well, you got them plaques on the wall. I said, that's just because I don't have pictures. I hang them up. But I put 160 out for garbage. I said, we need to go in every meet. I'd enter everything I could. And I used to come home sometimes, 2 or 3 trophies. I was lifting and entering a physique meet. I'd place in that or win it. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Just train. And train and try and get all the financial help you can get, if there is any out there. And train, do the right thing. If there is anything in the, I would say, in the diet type thing to help you, do it. Don't do drugs, any kind of drugs. That's for marijuana out. Don't do anything. But just train hard and set your goal. Set a goal. You know, just because I had some bad experiences financially, that don't mean everybody has to or should. It's a little, seems to be a little more help for athletes out there. Sometimes your parents come from Europe to move here. Well, maybe you got to move somewhere else, go out to Denver, Colorado, and train out there at the Olympic headquarters. You know, they have training out there. You'll get help out there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them don't realize that. I mean, if that would have been around probably before I was married, I would have been out there. I would have trained out in Denver. I get a kick because they put a little thing in one time about what are they doing now, and I was probably 70 or something, and I was lifeguarding. And they put a couple pictures in the Olympic news thing a few years ago and had my picture in and standing by a lifeguard chair and a little article. It was good.
That is cool.
So, you missed it? Well, it's been a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that you would like to talk about or share? Any other memories or stories?
Well, not really. Like I said, through injuries and financial things, it was rough. But the experience that they can't ever take away from you, and they say, never say you were former. They always say past. Or, you never were past, you never were former, and there's something else. You are an Olympian, and they can't take that away from you. They can, in fact, I had some surgery done. I had open heart bypass surgery. And the nurse said, hey, the doctor said you were the Olympics. And the doctor, wanted a picture of me, said his son, who was a doctor in New York. So I give him a picture, autographed, you know. Well, I went into surgery. When I come out, I don't think these nurses believe it. They went right on that computer. And there was a picture in there when I still had hair. And they had them, when I come down to the recovery room, they had pictures of me blown up all over the room.
Oh, how neat.
And I had a laugh because they didn't believe me. Now, the doctor did. my radiant doctor that operated on me, and he wanted a picture. And his theory was my son's sitting there, and I am really out of it for like a day. You lose a day. And he comes in to see me after the surgery, and I'm out. My son is sitting there, and he said to my son, he didn't say nothing about my heart. He said, what the heck ever happened to your dad's knees? My son said he had about 5 or 6 operations on both of them. And the arthritis in them and everything. But I had a lap heart surgery talking about my knees.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it was a great experience. Would I do it again? As a youth, probably as a youth, I would say yes. My mind, after going through the all experience, would you do it again? I don't know. You know, but I do like nobody picking me. You either win or you don't win, or you either lift it or you don't lift it. So that was my greatest thing about really going to weightlifting, because I didn't like, because if you had your personality or you didn't kiss up to the 7 judges at the physique meet, if you kissed up to them, you got 2, 3 more points. I'm not doing that.
Yeah. So the subjective.
I don't want to win because somebody likes me.
Yeah.
I want to win because I win.
Yeah, that makes sense. So that's the physique competitions were just too subjective for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I myself have won a few physique meets in Wilmington, Delaware, and around open meets, and I shouldn't have won. I go look through my picture book every once in a while, pictures that I collected. I'm standing beside a couple of these guys. They look 10 times better than me. Although at my time, I was a very artistic poser. I could really go through a posing routine, you know, like put a flow, almost like I was a ballet dancer or something. But my posing beat a lot of these guys I thought were better than me because I displayed myself much better than they did.
I see.
But like I said, I don't want to be picked.
Yeah.
I mean, I have pictures and, you know, I don't even dawn on it anymore. I have so many tournaments that I won it. Pass. My dear, it was very nice talking to you. This was like 1 hour and 5 minutes, and I'll tell you what, it was a great 1 hour and 5 minutes.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Well, thank you for being generous with your time and your memories, Bob. I really appreciate it.
I'll probably think about them all day now that you ask so many questions. I really, it was an experience that you'll never, never imagine to do again in anything.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, I mean, especially when you know you did it because you wanted to do it. Nobody was paying you. Everything was because you wanted to do it, and you wanted to do the best you could. And as a representative, you know, other than that, I had a nice talk with you, and I think it was very good.